Follow the Sound. I am your host, back again after I was gone for a week without it. But I am back. I am your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me is Jacob Crum.
Good evening. I have been loving the weather today.
Yeah, it's been a very nice day here in the good old St. Louis area. Nice and cool, but not too cold. It was good. It was
great.
Very nice.
Skies, some brown, crinkly leaves blown across the road.
Yeah. It's nice. My favorite time of year, too. I've always liked that. If you're wondering, Greg Harvey is out sick tonight. We hope he gets better, but he was just a bit under the weather. Yeah, there you go. So, if you're wondering what this episode is about, you probably already read it in the description for when you clicked on it. But we're going to do ourselves another episode of This Week in Music History. But before we get to our great selections this week, of course, you can always help out our show by going to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and click on that Amazon banner on the right-hand side. It'll take you to Amazon, do all of your normal shopping, and then we get a little bit of money back. It's just that simple. Won't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money, and it helps us continue doing the show. So go to the website, click on the banner, or you can just skip that and go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. It'll take you there, too. So let's get into This Week in Music History. Of course, we have November 13th through November 17th, which would be Monday through Friday. Right? Yes, because this is what we do. So, starting out on November 13th, we're going back to the good year of 1968 with Hugo Montenegro. Jake, do you know who Hugo Montenegro is?
No.
That was a nice little pause you had there. So, Hugo Montenegro in 1968 actually made it to number one on the UK singles charts. Now, it's kind of interesting that he makes it on there because most people were probably like, who in the world is Hugo Montenegro? Well, Hugo Montenegro is actually on the UK singles chart for the song The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, which, of course, everybody knows the song, even if they don't know it's called The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, because it goes, you know, it's that that's that song, okay? It's got those drums in the background. Of course, it comes from the Clint Eastwood spaghetti western film called The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. And honestly, if you've never done a good dive into Clint Eastwood westerns, you're missing out because they are some fantastic works. But it was the first instrumental to hit number one in the UK since 1963. I didn't look up what the other song was that hit number one in 1963. You're just going to have to either search for us or eventually we'll come to it. I don't know. But I got to move on to the next one because I'm also doing that one, which is 1969. Now, this story was actually discovered by Jake. And when I saw it, I cracked up. And I'm picking this as the most pointless music history fact of the episode, but still by far, in my opinion, the more interesting thing because I like goofy, pointless things. 1969, John Lennon of the Beatles purchases the island Doranch off of the coast of Ireland, and he bought it for £1,700. Not a whole ton of money, you know, a good amount, but it's a decent little island, right? It was previously used by sailing ships for its stones, and the island became a place of peace for Lennon and his family. After his divorce from his wife, Cynthia, the island went unused until Lennon invited the king of hippies, Sid Rowley, to establish a commune on the island in 1970. For the next 2 years, a group of 25 hippies called Doranch home, until in 1972, a fire burned down the island's supply tent because they hadn't built a better thing. They just had a supply tent. And the commune disbanded. Hey, that's amazing. If you don't have food to give everyone, society crumbles and everyone just scatters. So after Lennon's death, though, Yoko Ono sold the island for nearly 30,000 pounds and donated the proceeds to an Irish orphanage. Dorange, I have no idea if I'm actually saying that right. If somebody speaks Irish.
I don't know. I would have Dornish, an opinion.
Dornish.
But I've seen three different ways that the name is spelled.
It's Ireland. I can't begin to... who knows how they pronounce it. But apparently Dornish is now used as a grazing site for livestock and is sometimes visited by enthusiastic Beatles fans.
Now, here's what I think is the most interesting factoid about this island.
Go for it.
Is that I found a list of demographics for it based on census data.
Oh, yeah?
So if you want to know, the island is currently uninhabited. Uninhabited. And has had zero population since 1981. At its height, its population was the undocumented time in 1970 when 25 people were living on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Previously, okay, in 1969,
right. Yes.
It had a population of one.
Oh, okay.
Okay. You ready for this? So, when John Lennon bought the island and established a commune, the population jumped.
Okay.
By 25,000%.
So I'm looking at a picture of the island right now.
Yes.
It's a big random island. Like
yes.
It's just there's nothing mm-hmm. really there. There looks like it's got some sandbars around it. And it's basically just a flat thing with a couple of what look like maybe some stone fencing. That's it. Looks like there might have been something built over on one side at some point, but there's nothing there now. There's obviously no way that Google actually like took people out there and took video, like or did the car driving around in a field. So
no.
Yeah, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
That's
but
it.
I love the population in 1841 was 15. 1851, zero.
Oh, nice.
So 1871, 15.
If you're wondering, it's near the town of Inishgort.
There you go. I think we've said enough.
I told you it's the most pointless music history fact of the night. But for some reason, I thought this was interesting. And I was like, why not? The weird little story of a tiny Irish island, and John Lennon bought it at some point in 1969. Good on you, John. Moving on up. Oh, see, I got to do the next one too, don't I? Man,
yeah.
I'm just cruising along with these. 1990, this one busted me up. All right, November 13th, 1990, Patricia Botten filed a lawsuit against Rod Stewart. There you go. That's it. That's all I got for that. No. There's much more to this story, although I'm going to keep it pretty short. So what happened was Rod Stewart apparently kicked a football out into the audience. And Patricia happened to try and catch this ball. And when she did, she tore a tendon in her middle finger. I'm not sure if it was her right or her left.
Do we know that she was trying to catch it?
I would assume that it was being kicked out there, and like maybe he kicked it a little mm-hmm. too hard or something.
I mean, it's possible that the airborne football caused her to go into a panic.
It's possible that somebody bumped into her when they were trying to catch it and bent her finger.
Too.
I don't know how that's possible, but I'm thinking of like somebody trying to catch it and it like hits it,
mm-hmm.
like just the tip of the finger, and like caused her to rupture a tendon or something. Now you're thinking, okay, well she got hurt at a concert because of something he did. You know, okay, so she can sue. That wasn't the end of the story. She claimed that because her tendon had been ruptured on her middle finger, that the injury had made sex between her and her husband difficult.
Oh, let me think about that for a second. Okay.
So. Yep. Work it out. Do the biology.
Here's the thing. I mean, you just got to roll lefty. It's for the relationship, you understand. you got to roll lefty after
if
that.
If someone can explain to me how this actually plays out, I would like to know, because this is honestly one of the most ridiculous mm-hmm. lawsuit claims I've ever heard in my life. It almost makes me wonder how many times other people have been just like, you know, oh, I hurt my toe, I can't have sex now. Like, something along those lines. Just to try and increase the amount of money.
Well.
Who knows? Who knows? But there you go. Patricia Botten, you're kind of a horrible human being. So, I'm going to claim that right now. All right, let's
also
move on.
Also on that same day, yes, in 1990, at the Off-Ramp in Seattle, Temple of the Dog played their only show. One caveat to that. Compromise. Now, Temple of the Dog was a band that had members of Soundgarden.
Yes.
Notably Chris Cornell. And members of Mother Love Bone, whose lead singer, Andrew Wood, had just died of a heroin overdose.
Yes.
Later, that band became Pearl Jam, but before Pearl Jam, they came together for this one-off Temple of the Dog show, wrote some new music for it, and recorded it as a tribute.
Yes.
So there was an album produced out of that, and they played one show.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last year, they actually got together and did a reunion tour.
Yes.
They did a few shows. So to say their only show is not true anymore.
Yeah. But still, at the time, it was their only show.
Right.
I like that, though. That's still pretty good.
Okay.
You're going to have to close out the day.
Yeah, let's close out the day. 2004, A Tribe Called Quest is playing their first reunion show at a festival called Rock the Bells in Anaheim, California.
Yes.
Shortly before taking the stage, they receive word that Old Dirty Bastard, ODB, had just collapsed in studio during a recording session and died.
Mm-hmm.
So A Tribe Called Quest goes out to open the festival, and they just start doing Wu-Tang songs. They didn't even play their own music for the first 16 minutes.
Mm.
Just boom, just started pulling out Wu-Tang songs, doing them.
I like it.
That's really, no, you don't get it, man. They had zero time to prepare. He collapsed in the studio at 4:35 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So at most they had what, like an hour, maybe 2 hour ahead notice, like to go like, hey, we're gonna play some Wu-Tang stuff today.
Hmm. Man, I tell you what though, it's like, that is impressive. I like that. That's all I got. I don't know what else to say.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Hey. Yeah. Well, hey, I really like Wu-Tang and Tribe Called Quest. So.
Yeah. No. I definitely enjoy their music. So. That's still pretty impressive. In the future episode that we're going to do, where I review the concert that I went and saw, I'll have a similar story actually, although nobody died. But I'll get back to that.
Okay then.
So let's go ahead and move on to November 14th. In 1936, born on this day, somebody who most Americans probably don't know was born. And that man was Freddie Garrity. Now, of course, Freddie Garrity was the vocalist for Freddie and the Dreamers. And they had such great hits as in You Were Made for Me, which, if you ever listen to it, that's the entire hook of the song. You were made for me, everybody tells me so. It's this goofy little song. And every single song that he did had to have some weird dance thing to it that everybody else did, including the one song that was like their other big hit, I'm Telling You Now, which is I'm Telling You Now.
Ugh.
And everybody does these weird like kicks off to the side and everything. Mm. It's like it was a weird shtick and really gimmicky, but at the same time, a dude was goofy as all get out, and he really knew how to market himself. So.
I've seen the old performances of them, and you told me that they still did that.
Yes.
Like they, I don't want to see like 70-year-old men doing gimmicky dances on stage.
Well, unfortunately, Freddie Garrity died the 19th of May in 2006. And I believe we've actually mentioned that on the show when May rolled around and Freddie Garrity's death day came about. So I'm a fan of his because I saw him randomly on some stupid TV show from back in the day, and it was like, oh, hey, that dude's really goofy, but actually kind of, the song's catchy, so There you go. Anyway. But he was in the same group though. Like he was popular in the UK like the same time all of these other like super popular British bands were out there, and we all know about them. My dad knows about Freddie and the Dreamers, and I'm sure a few other people do too. But like he never had like the mainline success that the Beatles had, but he hung out with the Beatles and like stuff. So
I was thinking of all of how many better bands there were in England in 1963.
I don't know, but there were a lot of bad ones too.
Yeah, that's true.
So
that, well,
we
okay,
only
fair
got
enough.
See, that's the thing. Everybody's fair like, enough. I love the British invasion. It's like, yeah, that's because the only ones that invaded were the good ones. It's like all the other really sucky British bands didn't make it. It's like for every cool, like you look at the Rolling Stones and you're like, oh, they were kind of a cool, like British, like blues rock kind of band. Yeah. There were 300 other British blues rock bands that didn't make it. Or do anything good because they all sucked and all they did were covers. Heck, Fleetwood Mac started out as a blues British like rock band and then sort of transitioned into what they currently are, you know, because they picked up Lindsay and Stevie and all that. But that's exactly what they were. If you listen to old Fleetwood Mac stuff, they were totally a blues band. That's what they were. So
happy birthday, Freddie.
Happy birthday, Freddie.
Freddie Garrity.
Yes, you will. You are missed on this earth. Let's go ahead and move on up to 1960. On November 14th, Ray Charles went to number one on the U.S. singles chart with Georgia on My Mind. Still one of my favorite songs of his. Not, I mean, I like a lot of Ray Charles songs, but that was it's still one of my favorites. And I believe it is now the state song of Georgia. So there you go.
You could do a lot worse.
You could do a lot worse. Way better than Illinois and their state song. I hate that stupid
Illinois
song. Yeah. So dumb. Why can't we get a cool Illinois song?
I would be fine with Sweet Home Chicago.
Yeah. It's like that's so city centric.
It's a good song though.
Yeah. I don't think New York is the song for the state of New York because it's all about the city, but I'm just saying. There's so many, like, there could be a good song about Illinois.
Well, you don't know what it is.
The like, state you song can, to Illinois?
You give me a, no. I'm saying give me another, if it's not going to be Sweet Home Chicago, what, like, you're like there's got to be, well, if you don't know it, it can't be that
no,
great.
No, I'm just saying somebody could write one.
Oh, well, all right.
Yeah, the state song of Illinois is Illinois.
Illinois, yeah, it's kind of terrible.
What's it for Missouri? Just so I can look it up.
Bare Necessities.
That'd be hilarious. It's just the Missouri Waltz. It's just a song called the Missouri Waltz. Wow, that's so horrible.
It should be Maybelline. It really should be.
Forget if it actually says anything about the state. It's just a song like that was written in that state.
I mean,
North Dakota is like screwed because nobody wrote anything up there. They got some song written by some local dude.
No, you could borrow something from
Bismarck.
You could borrow something from like John Denver or Spirit in the Sky. Like, why not?
Just say like Colorado obviously needs to use John Denver's Rocky Mountain High. You know.
And then everyone else, Idaho, is all upset because they're like, the Rockies are up here, too.
Somebody else is trying to do something. West Virginia could have Country Road by John Denver.
Yeah.
You know, because they talk about West Virginia in there.
Anyway.
Florida could have Flo Rida.
Because you were always on my mind. Next up, the state. Of Florida, in the hit with the bird and the berry back cheese and the apple pie. She hit the flow. Next thing you know, yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. Florida,
what,
get
what,
on
what,
that.
What's going to be the theme from Miami Vice? All right, so 1999. Something nearly unprecedented.
That was Hawaii 5-0. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got my songs mixed up.
Yeah. No, Miami Vice starts out with a
Yeah, that's right. Yep, you're correct. All right, what were you going on?
Oh, 1999. Something somewhat completely unprecedented happens. EMI Music Distribution offers retailers a $3 rebate for an album that was just released called The Life of Chris Gaines.
Now, who is Chris Gaines there, Jake?
Why don't you tell me who Chris Gaines is?
Chris Gaines?
Because I don't know who Chris Gaines is. That's why I'm listening to the album. I want to find that out.
Chris Gaines does not exist.
You lie. Don't be messing with Chris
Gaines,
Brian. Chris
Gaines was like the alternative rock persona of country legend Garth Brooks.
Dude, okay, Garth Brooks was making people so much money.
Yes, he was.
So much money. That when he came to them and said, look, I want to do a new concept album, everyone went, that's great. Let's do it. What is it? He goes, I'm going to put on high heels and eyeliner and turn myself into a glam emo rocker. And I'm going to change my name to Chris Gaines. And then I'm going to talk about myself in third person when I'm Chris Gaines. And then I'm going to talk about Chris Gaines when I'm Garth Brooks. And we're all going to find out who Chris Gaines is. And they went, let's do it.
Oh, man. I'm reading about Chris Gaines because apparently he has his own Wikipedia. Chris Gaines is a fictional rock star persona created as an alter ego for Garth Brooks to explore rock and roll styles far removed from his success as a country singer.
Do you remember the interviews when that album came out?
It was horrible.
There was like an ABC television 1-hour special
about
the album. And I just remember Garth Brooks saying, like, who is Chris Gaines? Where does Chris Gaines begin and Garth Brooks end? I don't know. That's what I want to find out.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen his YouTube channel?
I have not.
It's insane.
That sounds awesome. It's insane. Though.
It's like he talks like an alien studying human beings and not so much as just a human being doing a video blog.
Well, I mean, he only did the one album, so at least we have that.
Well, yeah, that's true.
It still went 2 times platinum in the U.S., though.
I mean, partially because they did the price drop on it with the $3 rebate.
Fascinating, though. Fascinating character.
Anyway.
Let's go ahead and move
on. 1 year later, in 2000, The Offspring appear on MTV to host a one-off game show. For the last year, any fan who purchased a download of the song Original Prankster from their website was automatically entered into a drawing to appear on the game show with a chance to win $1 million. 2 contestants were chosen randomly out of those entries, and 14-year-old Ashley Hitchcock won when he correctly identified Noodle as the oldest member of the band. The whole thing was a stunt to announce a newly released album that released on the same day called Conspiracy One. But $1 million.
Yeah, that's still
14-year-old Ashley Hitchcock.
I wonder what's going on with Ashley these days.
Probably wishing he hadn't wasted that $1 million.
I'm sure.
Or I don't know. That guy could have started a surfboard shop. I don't know.
I want to find out.
Oh, don't Google it.
We don't have time for Googling,
man. We got other stories to do.
Get to the next story. You're reading the next one anyway.
All right, fine. 2005. Mark Ross, known as Brother Marcus from the rap group 2 Live Crew, files a lawsuit on Ice-T claiming that he helped write the original version of 99 Problems, which became a gigantic hit for Jay-Z. That's what people still talk about, 99 Problems. It's like possibly the greatest hip-hop song ever. However, in an interesting contrition from the former 2 Live Crew member, his lawsuit stated, counsel for the plaintiff apologizes to the court for the graphic and profane nature of this song included in the body of its complaint.
Okay.
He filed the lawsuit and they settled out of court.
Oh.
he had written most of the song. Yes. However, he had been paid like $10,000 in royalties. And Mark Ross was like, hey, I know I deserve more than $10,000 for this shit.
Yeah. Understandable.
What do you think of 99 Problems, Ryan?
Well, I only knew the Jay-Z version.
Yes.
So I didn't know that it was even like sort of a remake.
No, no, no. He wrote it. And just as a writer, his royalties.
Well, it's okay, because you said, like, you know, he helped write the original version of it, which then became a hit for Jay-Z.
So, oh, okay. Well, there have been like 30,000 remixes of 99 Problems by DJs and other people.
Well, of course, yes. So, I don't know. I mean, it's. Seems pretty straightforward. I mean, he wanted to get some more money, so why not?
I'm talking about 99 Problems as a song.
Yes.
You a fan of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought it was kind of a catchy, you know, a catchy thing to do. But...
It took, like, I don't know, my 12th or, like, 15th listen before I even caught what the lyrics were saying. Like, 99 Problems when a bitch ain't one. I didn't realize that, like... This, like, it's an interesting hip-hop song because it's from the perspective of an officer who's doing a traffic stop and feels bad about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a cool song. There you go. Bam. Done.
There you go.
November 15th.
November 15th.
1968. Russell Jones is born in Brooklyn, New York. He would later become known as Old Dirty Bastard.
Yeah, so you almost made it to his birthday then.
One day short of 36.
Wow. What did he die from anyway?
The official cause of death was overdose.
Oh.
I think he had coke and some kind of prescription depressant in him as well.
Mm.
I'm sure he'd been up for a few days too. He partied hard.
Yeah.
He did, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine.
I miss that dude.
Yeah.
He was nutty. I liked him.
I'd like to point out, apparently the rumor has it that Ashley Hitchcock blew all the money and now doesn't have any. So
okay, well.
There you go. I just wanted to point that out.
99 Problems, but a game show ain't one. So.
Okay, so happy birthday to Russell Jones.
Happy birthday.
But moving on to the next year,
mm-hmm.
This is an interesting story.
And I think I'm going to have to read this one just for the sake of
yes,
the integrity of the show.
Integrity of the show, absolutely.
Exactly. Because I wouldn't want anyone to misquote Miss Janis Joplin. 1969, Janis Joplin calls out a police officer at her concert in Tampa, Florida, when he uses a bullhorn to yell at audience members who have left their seats. She screamed at the officer, "Don't fuck with those people! What are you so uptight about? Did you buy a $5 ticket?" I'm sorry. If Janis Joplin like started screaming, like, "Don't fuck with those people" at me, like, immediately my butthole would tighten and I would just probably sit down. Not on anything. I would just, like a dog, just sit down. Like, okay, what are we doing next? So anyway, the cop then got into it with Janis Joplin and told her to address the audience members and tell them that they had to remain seated during the concert. To which she replied, "I'm not telling them shit." however, she didn't get to finish the concert because she was arrested on the spot for vulgarity and indecent language, which I didn't know you could be arrested for in Florida.
Mm.
But I'm assuming those are that's still on the books somewhere, and it's a really dumb fucking law.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so she posted bail, and then the charges were later dropped and reduced to like some kind of stupid disturbance of the peace. Even though like who comes to a Janis Joplin show for peace? like I'll go to a Janis Joplin show just so I can chill and mellow out.
That's true.
Yeah, and pay to find, and that cop, continued to be an asshole, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
I don't know, but I really wish there was like a cap to put on the tail of this story, but there's not.
There's not, no. Let's jump on up to 1986. I put this one in here just because I thought it was interesting. Pop history was made when the top five UK singles were all female vocalists.
Mm.
We had Corinne Drury with Swing Out Sister, Mellon Kim, Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles,
And Kim Wilde and Terry Nunn from Berlin, who are at number one with the song Take My Breath Away. Weirdly enough, yes. Jessica started singing that randomly when she was in the kitchen, and to which then I responded, hey, did you know that they're supposedly making a sequel to Top Gun? To which then she responded with, oh, is that the movie that song's from? And I died a little inside.
Yeah.
Because that's one of my favorite movies.
Oh, now. you never failed disappointment, Brian.
I know. You know me. I like I jets know. And stuff.
But so. I want to curtail
this. I don't like it because of the volleyball scene, if that's what you're wondering.
Oh, I'm sure.
I like it because it's got jets in it.
Keep telling yourself that.
And I like jets, mm-hmm. especially F-14s, because those jets are cool.
And apparently impromptu karaoke.
And MiGs aren't actually they're not MiGs in that movie, but they
oh, what did they
there.
Use for MiGs? Is it a French fighter?
It wasn't a French jet. It was like another American jet. It's just that it looked really cool and sleek, and so they're like,
it's a MiG.
It's a MiG. Like, okay. nobody freaking noticed anyway. It's like at the time it was in the middle of the Cold War, and so everybody was just like, oh, there's no way that the Russians are actually going to let us use jets from there. So, but yes, it is true. Apparently they are trying to get a Top Gun 2 made, where Maverick is now an instructor at Top Gun. So he's taking on like the Ironside or whatever.
We as a culture need to get together and stop giving Tom Cruise a career.
He's not that bad.
I'm just saying.
He does popcorn flicks, man. That's what he's good for. Can't your sing to save his life, though.
Your definition of good is much different than mine.
Hey, I'm not saying it's high art. I'm just saying it's entertaining.
The last good film he was in was Legend.
He's been in some good ones since then. Okay.
I had the biggest, like, just stupid grin on my face when I said that.
Let's jump on up a few more years.
No.
Still want to go on?
I want a rabbit hole on the band Berlin.
Okay, go ahead.
Because I still maintain that there is no good band named after a geographic location.
Even with Berlin?
Berlin, again. Not good.
Maybe they were taking it for its actual like German translation, you know, which is the land of bears.
Either way, they're just not a good band.
Honestly, besides Take My Breath Away, I don't know any other songs. Right. But
they are one that I always forget when I name off bad bands.
Oh, they're named after places?
Right.
Yeah. I could see that.
America and Europe are usually one and two.
Mm.
Sometimes it's Europe and America, but
so any countries, continents, cities,
any geographic location, they're all terrible.
Huh?
They're all bad, Brian. All of them.
I'm hard pressed to like find one that I could actually say, you know, legitimately, like, you know, this band is amazing. But, yeah, I can't really think of one right off the bat.
The one that people try and defend so much. They're like, oh, the first two Boston albums were great.
Hey, first two Boston albums were great. With Siv Hashian on drums and, oh, no. Dude, seriously.
Man, I'm not doing this just to be a dick. I can't stand Boston.
I know you can't.
Stand Boston.
I know you can't.
I will put together an argument that those albums, if you give me time, I will put together an argument that those two albums are garbage.
I love it. It's got the high tenor voice, got like some talented musicians, like doing these big long rock songs and stuff that like were sort of what came out of like.
Listen, Brian, Boston is the Congo of music.
That's not true.
It is true. Look. The Congo, the movie The Congo.
Yes.
Right? With Ernie Hudson.
Written by Michael Crichton. Yep.
And.
Wait, we're talking about different things, I think.
Yeah, the book, The Congo, right?
I think it's just called Congo.
Congo, right? But the movie.
It's about the gorillas. Yeah, it's a
First
Michael Crichton
off,
book.
Barely has anything to do with the book.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Of course, that was back in the day when they were just like, Michael Crichton wrote Jurassic Park.
Exactly.
Let's make all of his movies into books.
Exactly.
All of them. Timeline. Congo.
I've seen a lot of shit for Sphere. I still think Sphere is a decent, okay movie.
Sphere's book is amazing.
It's really good.
It's really good. And the audiobook is even better because it's read by Ed frickin' Asner.
Okay, so the Congo, right? Congo.
Yes,
that
Congo.
Movie had talent packed in it every which way, right? Every single person that was behind the scenes from the key grips, mm-hmm. right? Like every cameraman, like every camera operator that was on there was a Steadicam operator because the director was like, I don't know when I'm going to use a Steadicam.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to get every Steadicam operator in this movie. Just, I'm going to hire them all. So I can use ten at a time if I want. The director of photography, the cinematographer, everyone on there had just gotten done like the previous year winning Academy Awards for various things. It was packed with talent. But that movie is garbage, just like Boston. Boston packed with talent, terrible band. Anyway, I'll let you move on to the next. The next band, which actually cannot be defended.
Yeah, that is true. So going on up to 1990, Milli Vanilli producer Frank Farian held a press conference to confirm the rumors that the two members of the group, Rob and Fab, had not sung on any of their hit records.
You know,
hey, Jake, remind me again how they were caught.
Girl, you know it's 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 girl.
I think we got it. So the funny thing is, I'm actually, I was trying to figure out if Michael Farian happened to be Armenian because he's got the IAN at the end of his name.
Oh, dude.
But I don't know. I can't find it because he's German, but he, you know, who knows?
I always feel bad because I don't know the name of the actual vocalist that have never been given credit for that album.
Yeah.
One of these days, I'm just going to have to learn it because, yeah.
Yeah, I always forget who it is, too. But, I mean, that's just who I am. I always forget names anyway. So, I just wanted to point out, though, that he actually had, like, a couple of good hits. I mean, not just Milli Vanilli. I'm talking about Frank Farian.
Yeah.
Because he was actually the one who put together the group Boney M.
Yeah.
And Boney M was like one of the best disco groups ever.
I would say the only good disco group almost.
They're one of the only disco groups that I can actually watch,
mm-hmm.
like see videos of, and I'm like, all right, this is actually pretty catchy. Anybody who can do a song about Rasputin,
yeah.
And like make it sound.
Rasputin, lover of the Russian queen. There was a cat that really was gone.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I
always
like the guy because he's always dancing like a crazy person.
Yeah.
But even in like that song in Rasputin, he's, you know, he's like, it's like, there lived a man in Russia long ago.
He was big and red and his eyes were flaming blue.
It's like this weird, like, gravelly voice that I loved. So, but yeah, there you go. Farian, like, of course, went on to do some other stuff. He did some stuff with Meatloaf. He did some musicals and stuff on Broadway and in London. And apparently also released like some other albums later on, but he seems to have back in the day actually released his own album in Germany called Wunderbar.
Ah, Wunderbar.
So there you go. I don't know. This dude looks Armenian. I'm just gonna say that right now. He might not be, but he looks like it. So, let's go ahead and move on to November 16th. I'll go ahead and take this one, I guess. 1964, The Animals record Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which is a great song.
Mm-hmm.
The song was written by Benny Benjamin, Gloria Caldwell, and Sol Marcus for Nina Simone, who actually recorded it in 1963, the year before. But The Animals were very good at doing covers.
Yes, they were.
And making them their own. Their version of
House of the Rising
Sun. House of the Rising Sun is that's still like the definitive version of that song. Their version of Paint It Black is my favorite.
Oh yeah.
Cuz it sounds so much cooler than what the Rolling Stones did, in my opinion. The Animals were one of these groups that honestly were like a proto-punk band, like before that was even a thing. And it's just because of how like really good they were and how good the lead singer was. So
yeah,
there you
no
go.
No joke. He, how do I not remember his name? Eric Burdon.
Yeah.
Eric Burdon has one of my favorite voices of all time.
So the other thing that I love about that song, though, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, is that that keyboard part.
Yes.
It's like that one.
Yes.
I love it.
I do want to say something about this song. When Nina,
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Hold on, please don't let me be misunderstood.
So
yeah, what about Nina Simone?
Okay, so when Nina Simone did the song, it was about half the speed, really slow. And the lyrics feel very different when she sings them.
Of course they do. It's Nina Simone. She's a jazz singer.
That's true. Hang on.
Looking it up?
Yeah, I got to look up the lyrics because I don't want to get them wrong.
Oh.
But like when Nina Simone sings them, right? To me, right? Or like when she sings them, it's a song about the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Right? However, when Eric Burdon sings them, for some reason, it sounds like they're about spousal abuse.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. To me, it just comes across as a bit more angsty than anything. You know, like he's trying to talk to the authority, saying, it's like, hey, I'm a decent person. It's like, you know, you don't need to view me as something bad. But I guess I could see with some of the other lyrics involved that
yeah,
it could be
yeah,
about
but
that.
Like, if I seem edgy, I want you to know that I never meant to take it out on you.
Mm-hmm.
Life's had has its problems, and I've had my share.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I never mean to do.
Yes.
Because I love you, huh? Yeah. Anyway, it's a really great song.
Yep, yep, yep.
And I thought it was about Eric Burdon slapping women. until I heard Nina Simone sing it.
All right. So moving on up to 1968, here you go. This is one of these albums that gets brought up as in being like the definitive album for this band. Jimi Hendrix Experience go to number one on the U.S. album charts with Electric Ladyland. Now, if you get one of the original demo records, do you know what the title of the album is? Electric Landlady.
Electric Landlady.
Yeah, which is why those things are super, super rare because it's only a white label. Mm-hmm. Because it was the demo album that was like released to the press, basically. And so they all like, they printed it wrong because the people who were printing the labels thought they misspelled or they got it wrong with Landlady. Well, isn't that supposed to be Landlady? Yeah, we should probably fix it. So Electric Ladyland goes to number one on the U.S. album charts. It was a double album, which included the songs Crosstown Traffic, Voodoo Child, All Along the Watchtower, and featured guest appearances by Dave Mason, Steve Winwood, and Al Cooper. This is one of those albums that like defined what this band actually did. How many times like you still hear Voodoo Child? Like just from that intro of him scratching on the strings and doing the wah pedal.
Yeah.
Or his version of All Along the Watchtower.
Which is the definitive version of that song.
Honestly, it practically is. It being like only on par, in my opinion, with the Richie Havens version. But that's just because I love Richie Havens doing that song because it's very vocally driven. But the way that Jimi Hendrix does it is just like really, really good. Just a great song in general. So there you go. 1968. Number one on the U.S. albums chart, Electric Ladyland. Good song. Good album. We need to review that album, actually. We should probably do that.
We should.
All right, let's move on, Jake.
1986. In the wee small hours of the night.
Going for your NPR voice there,
yes,
huh?
Yes, yeah. In the wee small hours of the night, Satpal Ram stabs a fellow diner to death. This is going less faux to more just mock British.
Go
so
ahead.
I'm going to stop.
You just stop that
I'm just
going
to stop right now.
Just stop it.
Yeah. So Satpal Ram stabs a fellow diner in the Blue Sky restaurant in Birmingham, England. He is sentenced to life in prison the following year and becomes a subject of an Asian Dub Foundation song, Free Sat Pal Ram. Do you know who Sat Pal Ram is, Brian?
I have no idea.
Okay, so Sat Pal Ram was, man, I got to get the country right. He was an immigrant to the UK.
Yes.
And he was in a diner when he was, his version of the story is that, you know, he was attacked over some music that was, he got into an altercation with some other diners who were probably skinheads,
mm-hmm.
Over music that was playing in this restaurant.
Okay.
And he stabbed the guy and the guy died.
Yes.
He stabbed him with a steak knife that was on the table.
Ah.
And he never got to testify in court.
Okay.
Because the courts never brought in a translator.
Oh.
Apparently, they were confused as to what language he spoke. Officially, I think his immigration papers have him listed as being from Taipei.
Okay.
But no one's really sure exactly what country he was from, you know? So anyhow, so they brought in a translator, didn't speak his language. And then the judge was like, yeah, don't worry about it. I'll translate for him. Doesn't speak any Asian dialects. His barrister, I think they called him in the UK, right? His lawyer mm-hmm. met with him for 20 minutes for his defense. So he became the center point of what at the time was thought to be like a systematic failure of the justice system for immigrants in England.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are like, hey, they're poor. We don't really care if they get represented in court. He killed a guy with a knife.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
I'm just reading about, like, what actually happened.
Yes.
And, yeah, so, like, he, all of that stuff that you said, like, basically he couldn't testify. He couldn't, mm-hmm. he couldn't really say anything.
Didn't even know what was going on because nobody was telling him.
Yes. And so he said that the argument originally was over Asian music being played on the restaurant's radio system, became a physical fight, and Ram said that he stabbed one of the party, Clark Pierce, in self-defense after Pierce attacked him with a broken bottle. Pierce was taken later to the hospital and later died. So he was convicted in 1987, but he was apparently released. He was released on parole in June of 2002. And it was actually, he was recommended for parole in 2000, which is even more hilarious. So it took 2 years for them to even get that right.
Yeah.
God, remind me never to get arrested in Britain. Good Lord.
Well, you have one thing going for you, Brian.
I can speak
English, right?
Yeah, but I don't speak the Queen's English, so they can't bring in an American translator.
Yeah. So that I just remember that being a really big deal.
Yeah.
And there
I didn't actually know anything about it, so mm-hmm. that's fascinating.
I only know about it because
of the song.
And I remember an interview that Bono did about it. Like somebody asked him about Sat Pal Ram, and I carried that with me for years. Like, who is Sat? What is? I didn't even know that was a name.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was a term for, like, in the British justice system. Was like, that was like a, like, Sat Pal Ram was some kind of.
Yeah.
Anyway, never mind.
Well, there you go. I'm reading a bit more about him. So he got paroled. And saying that he kept protesting his innocence and vowing to fight. Apparently, though, later on, his life sentence was revoked and all of that was done. But he, oh man, like what's, I'm trying to read this because it's kind of written weirdly. Saying he was paroled, still protesting his innocence and vowing to fight to clear his name. Alas, he soon reverted to type. In May of the following year, his life sentence was revoked
following allegations of assault and criminal damage, and he remained unlawfully at large until he was arrested in April 2005 for assaulting two police officers in the course of his detention.
So oh, it's like
he got like arrested again like a few years later, like for apparently attacking cops.
Yeah, but during his detention.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're like, hang on, wait, hold up. We weren't supposed to lock you up. However, while you were locked up unjustly, might I add, 15 years ago, you punched a guy that mm-hmm. was locking you up unjustly. So we're going to haul you back in for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember there's a thing where like his sentence was revoked, and then the courts ruled that the governing body that revoked his sentence had no just cause. They didn't have that authority.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right. So anyhow, there you go. There's your homework for the week, listeners.
Yeah, if somebody can find out more information about this,
go
and
read
what
about Sat Pal Ram. Become an expert on the British justice system, and do your own show on it.
Yes,
and I will listen to it.
Start a podcast just based on the Sat Pal Ram case, and we'll be fine. Good. Let's go ahead and move on. 1988, former Beach Boys manager Stephen Love was sentenced to 5 years probation for embezzling almost $1 million from the group's accounts.
That doesn't seem like that's that much.
It's just like, but he was related mm-hmm. to like them,
I know.
Because it's, you know, Mike Love, Steve mm-hmm. Love.
Yeah.
It's like, so there's that. And then on top of that, like, you know, you're related to basically everybody else except for the one friend.
Yeah.
And yet you're still going to steal from them. But then it seems to me that there were a lot of artists that had a ton of money just stolen from them. I mean, even we talked about Ray Charles mm-hmm. earlier.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Ray Charles had like a dude who just stole money from him for basically his entire career. So,
like, well, there's also sometimes there's a fine line between embezzlement and investing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, let's say, let's just say, Brian, that you are a famous artist and I am your manager. Somehow I have control of your money.
Oh, okay.
And I go out and I invest it in a very risky venture that I want to happen.
Yes.
Right. And miraculously, Evian water becomes a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because I took your money from you illegally
mm-hmm.
and invested it. But I got a return, so mm-hmm. I gave you your money back plus some, and I came back and I said, hey, check this out. I made you a bunch of money. And you're like, when did you do this? I'm like, oh, I did it. Here you go. You'd be like, thank you. But if I came back and said, hey, look.
I just lost a crap ton of money.
I just gave $1 million to a guy that breaks off icebergs and tries to float them down the coast of the U.S. to New York to put them in harbor to melt to put in a bottle of water. You remember that from Brewster Killians?
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
All right. And it didn't make money. Now I'm embezzling.
Yeah.
See, whereas before go. I was making you money. Okay, so.
Let's go ahead and move on to our final day this week. Yeah, I
Let's
know the
do
show
it.
Is cruising along, but that's perfectly fine. We're trying to keep them a bit shorter now anyway. We're starting to hit like the 2 hour mark sometimes and all that.
It's for me, it's all the pace, Brian. It's
yeah, the pace. The pace is what I really care about anyway. So let's go ahead and move on to November 17th.
1938, Gordon Lightfoot is born in Orillia, Ontario, Canada. His first public performance was on his school's loudspeaker in his fourth grade when he sang Tooraloo-Ralooral.
Mm-hmm. Later on, of course, he'd be famous for the song, Sundown, you better take care if I find you've been creeping round my back stairs.
I always liked this song about the Evan Fitzgerald.
Yeah, that's always a good one. So Gordon Lightfoot is actually a cool, cool dude. He's basically worshipped in Canada. much like their other exalted prince, Bryan Adams.
Mm-hmm. And their queen, Celine Dion.
Yes, that is true. The greatest singer in the world. But yes, Gordon Lightfoot had numerous hits in Canada. And he had a few hits in America, which is why we know about him. But
here's something I didn't know until I read about his birthday.
What?
He used to write for Marty Robbins.
Oh, yeah?
The country singer. Like the weepy 50s music, Country Robin, Marty Robbins?
Yes.
Yeah.
So he had like a bunch of different, like Sundown, Carefree Highway, If You Could Read My Mind, Rainy Day, People, and The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. So he wrote songs for other people.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm going to go through a list here of people who recorded Gordon Lightfoot songs. And let me see if you recognize any of these names. Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Hank Williams Jr., The Kingston Trio, Marty Robbins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Judy Collins, Barbara Streisand, Johnny Mathis, Herb Alpert, Harry Belafonte, Scott Walker, Sarah McLachlan, Eric Clapton, John Mellencamp, Jack Jones, Bobby V, Roger Whittaker, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Glenn Campbell, The Irish Rovers, Nico, Olivia Newton-John, Paul Weller, Nine Pound Hammer, and Ultra Nate. Or Nate. I'm not entirely sure how to say it because it's got a little thingy above the E. So there you go.
Wait, Nico from the Velvet Underground, Nico?
Let me double check on who that Nico actually is.
I think that is.
German singer, songwriter, lyricist, composer, and fashion model, was known as a Warhol superstar.
Uh-huh.
She is known for her vocals on the Velvet Underground's debut album.
Okay, anyone that can write a song for both, I mean, are there two farther poles on the spectrum of normalcy than the Irish Rovers and
Nico
and the Velvet Underground?
Oh man. So yeah, he's still alive. He is age 78. So there you go. He will be enjoying his 79th birthday for November 17th.
Oh, happy birthday.
Man, Gordon happy Lightfoot. Birthday, Gordon Lightfoot.
Hats off to you.
You've been a profound singer-songwriter in the world of music, and it's been a pleasure hearing your music throughout my years. So there you go. Let's go ahead and move on. 1960.
Yes. None other than my, I'll just go out and say it. My favorite drag queen, RuPaul.
Okay.
Is born in San Diego, California.
Now, RuPaul, of course, if you're wondering why RuPaul is listed on a music show, that's because RuPaul actually did have a hit.
Oh, not just a hit. Right.
It was like the hit of the 90s for a good while.
It was for about a minute, yeah. Supermodel.
Yeah, supermodel. It was like, Vogue, strike a pose. That's the only thing I remember from that song.
All right, now here's what kills. This is what kills me, and I did not know this. Right, Brian, I'm just going to throw you take a guess, okay? How many albums has RuPaul released? Supermodel of the World was released in 1993.
I'm going to guess RuPaul has released...
Hang on, 1993, 2017, quick math, 7 plus 17... is 24. How many albums has RuPaul released in 24 years of releasing albums?
Is it going to be 24?
No. No, it's not.
Although
that would be an amazing buildup.
8?
11.
God, closer than
that. Is okay, that's working hard. That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
11 studio albums.
Yeah.
I don't know what the tracks are on all of them. They could be half covers. I don't know. But still, you're not sufficiently impressed.
No, I'm definitely impressed. That's a lot of albums that I've never heard. I've heard one song from all of those.
I've actually heard the last one.
Oh, yeah?
It came out this year.
Now, I'm sure they probably have used some of the songs on the show.
Yes.
On RuPaul's Drag Race. But, yeah, and actually I've never seen an episode of that show, so I can't tell you. I got nothing against RuPaul or drag queens, I guess. It's just that there's a ton of TV shows and I've never watched it. So.
So the last album, right?
Yeah.
It's called American.
And, okay. Bunch of Gordon Lightfoot covers?
No. Actually, they're all original compositions.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. Anyway, good on you, RuPaul. I'm a fan.
You are one... tall drag queen. I'm just going to point that out.
I really do love RuPaul, man. Like, I just do.
Yeah.
I'm going to say RuPaul is punk rock.
Yeah, especially for like what sort of sprouted out of the 90s and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely counterculture. Oh yeah. Oh, for
definitely
sure.
Counterculture.
That's why I can appreciate. I don't appreciate burlesque as the art form, right? I can't take two burlesque acts and go, this one's better than that one.
You know what? I'm the same. Like, burlesque to me has always been kind of like a pointless thing.
Okay.
Like, oh, okay, you want to dress up as a person from the 1920s and dance around on stage? Okay. Like, you know what we call that? Cosplay. That's what we call that.
Yeah, I think it's more than that now, though. It's not all throwbacks to speakeasies.
Of course, I mean, drag queens are basically cosplaying something else, too. So.
Yeah, but it's subversive cosplay,
that's
Brian.
That's true. But then again, I mean, back in the 90s, though, nerd culture like that would have been considered completely abhorrent.
Yeah.
It's like, but now in the 2000s and then 2010s, you know, nerd culture has become a dominant force in pop culture. So now it's like you can't, like, basically you have to say you're a nerd to get any kind of credit. It's like on something. So there you go. Happy birthday, RuPaul.
Happy birthday.
Moving on up, one of my favorite groups, 1962, The Four Seasons started a 5-week run at number one on the U.S. singles chart with Big Girls Don't Cry. Now, the group, it was actually their second number one of the year, but it only made to the top 13 in the UK. So I've always been a fan of the Four Seasons. Four Seasons are one of the primary reasons I learned to sing harmony, because I used to sit there and listen to the album, because the first two albums I bought were the greatest hits, or gold records of Elvis and the gold records of the Four Seasons. And I sat there and I listened to it over and over and over again, singing each individual part as best as I could. Now, of course, that was back when I was a child, so I could actually sing the high parts. I can't
do
that.
Not so much anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't sing those high parts anymore. It's like my voice just will not do that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, speaking of high notes, Brian?
Yes.
All right, a little bit of a plug for our next episode in the week.
What do we got?
Whole lot of high notes.
Oh, yeah.
Whole lot of high notes on that album.
Okay.
You want me to tell them what it is?
Yeah, go for it, since I'm going to release this one first anyway.
All right.
Go for it.
Black Sabbath, Headless Cross, Tony Martin can belt the upper register. Holy cow, it's haunting, it's terrifying, and I love it, and I think you're going to too.
All right, I'm looking forward to it. I've never heard it before, so.
Oh, you
I'm not a Black Sabbath connoisseur. I know the hits.
Yes.
But that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so
when you hear this album, you're going to ask the question, why is this not played on the radio?
All right, then that
you're
is what I will
that.
Do.
Okay.
Moving on up to one of my other favorite bands, though. In 1966, the Beach Boys were at number one on the singles chart with Good Vibrations. The story about how that actually came about, though, was as a child, Brian Wilson's mother told him that dogs could pick up vibrations from people so that the dog would bark at bad vibrations. And Wilson turned this into the general idea for the song. I've always been a fan of Brian Wilson, even when I didn't know who he was. Because I just knew that whoever was singing that high falsetto part on certain songs and like just the way the songs were written, I loved it. I've always been like a slightly bigger Beach Boys fan than I have been like a lot of other groups. So like even the Beatles to me, like I like the Beach Boys more than I like the Beatles. But to me, it's not really a competition. It's not like, you know, the Beach Boys are so much better than the Beatles and blah, blah, blah. It's not that. It's just that it connects with me more. The Beach Boys connect with me more than the Beatles do.
Okay. I mean.
Especially the later stuff. It's like when they really started getting out of the actual like surf and cars and like that kind of stuff, and they started getting into better topics.
Yeah.
And then of course with the release of Pet Sounds and then Good Vibrations and
here's the thing. I also don't want to get into a conversation of just, are the Beach Boys better than the Beatles, right?
Yeah.
Because it's...
It's a stupid conversation.
It's a dumb conversation to have. The thing that's incredible about the Beatles as a band is that they had three writers that were equally good.
Yes.
Writing music, whereas the Beach Boys had Brian fucking Wilson.
Yes. So...
Who was doing everything.
Yes. But I, to this day, one of my all-time favorite songs. And this is... heads and tails above like most other things.
Mm-hmm.
I can say I love a band, I love an album, I love a particular song, but this is honestly up there with like number two on my list of all-time favorite songs, and that's In My Room by the Beach Boys.
Yes.
That song to me is so freaking amazing. It's ingrained into me. You want to know what my number one actual pick is? Bright Eyes, No Brains by the Stereo. It's not the Stereo.
That's the Animal Gin.
It's Let Go.
Oh, it's Let Go.
Same guy.
Okay, yeah.
Same artist. It's different band. So there you go. Sorry. It's Let Go. It's on the it's at the end of their self-titled album, Let Go. And it's just Bright Eyes, No Brains is like my favorite song.
So okay. Back to Good Vibrations.
Go back to Good Vibrations.
That was on Pet Sounds.
Yes.
Was released as a single,
mm-hmm.
right? Back when singles were a thing. What was the B-side?
I knew this at one point. I'm blanking, though. Which one was it?
Let's Go for a While.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Also good song, man.
Yeah. All right, go ahead and close out this entire shebang.
Let's do this. Very recent news.
Yes.
We don't even always crack 2000.
Yeah,
this last year. 2016, Peter Gabriel launches the Imprisoned for Art campaign, an effort to free prisoners around the world who have been sent to jail for opposing their governments through art.
Yeah.
And it was a really cool little project. He had a bunch of artists come in and mirror mugshots of the imprisoned artists
mm-hmm.
with their information around their neck in a mugshot.
Oh, nice.
It's pretty cool.
So, weirdly enough, I actually got to see some of the stuff there. I was when I was in New York this last week, we ended up going to the Guggenheim, the art museum in New York. And their main feature right now, their main like displays, are Chinese artists like after 1985. And so these absolutely are people who, like, if they go against the government in China, like they would have been imprisoned. And in fact, there were a couple of artists there that I was reading about how like they were imprisoned for basically doing an art piece that contradicted the party line.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't even a protest against it. It's just that it was something that like contradicted it, and so they were arrested for it and later freed. But I love the fact that Peter Gabriel actually does this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seek the attention, though.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everybody hears about everything that Bono does. You know, oh, we're trying to free such and such from some prison in the middle of nowhere. It's like, but Peter Gabriel, like, he kind of just goes out there and does things and doesn't really expect the recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always kind of admired that about him. Not to mention, I think he's got an incredible voice. Like, just that gravelly way he sings, just floors me every time I hear some of the old school stuff. In Your Eyes is also in my top 10.
Even the goofy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, only thing about me is the way that I walk, right?
Yeah.
And even then that is
like,
really...
Later on when he did his solo stuff, like Sledgehammer and like that kind of stuff, still loved that one. And then even more recently when he did a song that was called The Book of Love, which is not like the 60s, early 60s song, The Book of Love, which is one of the most annoying songs ever written. But he did this amazing song, and it's one of the best love songs I've ever heard in my life, and it's called The Book of Love. So Peter Gabriel consistently has done good music, and especially when he really got into like the world music stuff and made that actually a popular genre. Mm-hmm. Like, he kind of did it by himself. He was like, I'm a super famous star. I'm going to get all of these other different musicians about, and I'm going to make really cool world music type stuff with sort of a rock kilt to it.
Yeah. You know something is a fad when you walk into a truck stop and you can find it.
Yeah.
Because I remember I bought an album of just African beats at a truck stop for $3.
Yeah.
Because it's $3. Why not?
They got that and they got Irish music. Those are usually the two that you find. Like
what? In truck stops?
In truck stops. And then a ton of country.
A ton of dirty country.
Yeah, like bad country.
No, I don't mean bad country. I mean dirty country.
Yeah.
Like songs that are just about how bad a woman smelled.
But I'm going to tell you this, all right? If you go into a truck stop and you're looking through the albums and you find The Life of Chris Gaines, run away.
Run away.
Get you don't need that kind of negativity in your life. All right, folks, that's all we got for this week. Oh, what? Jake's throwing his hands up in the air.
I just want to say that the Imprisoned for Art campaign teamed with the Voice Project.
Okay, yeah.
You can still go to voiceproject.org. It's an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people give their time and effort to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just try and draw attention to artists that are in prison.
Yes.
For being artists.
Yes, exactly. So, either way, this has been a fun episode for me. I know Jake enjoyed it too, because he looks extremely ecstatic right now, and he's nodding his head enthusiastically. But thanks, folks, for listening. This has been Follow the Sounds This Week in Music History, November 13th through November 17th. We really hope that you enjoyed the show. Remember, if you want to help us out, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Do all that shopping, especially with Thanksgiving coming up around the corner and the Cyber Monday deals that pop up. Please help us out and go through our website, and we can get a little bit of money. And it, mind you, it doesn't go to like our pockets. It's not like I'm just trying to get you to do this just so we can earn a profit. It's like it legitimately helps keep the show going and keeps the network going as well. So please help us out. Go to the website, click on that banner. And that's all I got. So, of course, this has been Follow the Sound. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. And along with me has been Jacob Crum.
You could have an aeroplane flying if you'd bring your blue sky back.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.